This is an ABC podcast.
Back in 2014, in an interview with the BBC, the late Stephen Hawking was asked for his thoughts on the development of artificial intelligence. He didn't hold back.
The primitive forms of artificial intelligence we already have proved very useful. Once humans develop artificial intelligence, it would take off on its own and redesign itself at an ever-increasing rate. Humans, who are limited by slow biological evolution, couldn't compete and would be superseded. The development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race.
Others since that time have also expressed apprehension about the future of AI. But academic and author Brett Fryshman has a different fear. He argues that human beings are starting to act like machines, that they're being groomed to become more robotic in their behaviour and interactions. He's our feature guest today on Future Tense. We'll also take a trip to the Arctic Circle to find out why the software development company GitHub is interested in an old abandoned mineshaft in the very north of Scandinavia. But that's to come. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to the program.
I'm more concerned with the deployment of AI in pretty much every environment that you live your life, that you develop as a human being from the time you're a baby until the time you die. You're always in a process of development, and that development is always contingent on the environment you find yourself in.
Professor in law, business and economics, Brett Fryshman, author of Reengineering Humanity.
We become more machine-like, more predictable and programmable the more we outsource various aspects of our own thinking. It's not necessarily that we are thinking like machines. It's that we behave more and more like machines as we outsource thinking to the tech that we become so reliant on. The intent of the designers isn't to make you a machine or to make you stop thinking. It's the intent of the designer is to reduce the transaction cost to zero, to make the interaction as efficient as possible. So in pursuit of the logic of efficiency, right, and minimizing the transaction costs and to get you to the desired outcome, the desired result, yes, the design of many human-computer interfaces is oriented towards stimulating automatic, unthinking responses by us. Now, these aren't all, it's not concerted action across all of the different service providers that they're all trying to design an interface that nudges you to not think or lose your autonomy. It's that the logic of the digital networked world we've been building for the last, two decades, plus the logic of sort of that drives us towards, we have very short attention and we want to get to what we want to get to as quickly as possible, leads not to concerted action, but just to lots of people adopting the same human-computer interface design because it's efficient and it gets things done.
You point out that the process of re-engineering humans, as you say, at least in the workplace context, dates back to the early years of the 20th century and Frederick Taylor's idea of scientific management, the idea of Taylorism. What's different, though, today? How is the situation in the 21st century? How is it different from that period?
We kind of see it being a more continuous development. In terms of the path we're on, is there's not some sudden break in terms of capitalism that occurred in like the early 2000s. We trace a lot of the path that we're on, the direction we're heading, the logics that are sort of driving us down this path, optimizing things for efficiency and productivity. The idea that what we're doing with techno-social systems, technologies and social systems, is basically managing human beings. We trace it back to Taylor, as you suggest, in sort of the development of Taylorism. So what Taylor did in the workplace was to say, we're going to use data. We're going to have people with stopwatches and notebooks walk around and sort of identify how long it takes you to perform this task or that task within a factory or within a different workplace setting. And then we're going to sort of change the incentive structure. We're going to keep track of how can we scientifically manage our laborers, our workers, to make them more productive and more efficient in terms of their production, their use of time and resources and energy. And so what changes over the course of the 20th century is just the better tools on one sense for surveillance, right? So instead of a stopwatch and a notebook and a person walking around collecting that data, you get cameras and computers. And, you know, we can go through the whole list of different sensors and computational technologies that dramatically increase the power that a manager who wants to scientifically manage, you know, workers can use. But the thing is, it's not limited. There's nothing about the logic of scientifically managing human beings. There's nothing about that logic that limits itself to the workplace. It applies to the home place and the set of digital network technologies that are ubiquitous, pervasive, highly personalized, often bodily, like sort of worn on our body or intimately connected to our body. And so the power of the tools and the ubiquity of the tools for scientifically managing us is increased in terms of scale, scope, and power.
And the end result of all of this, if we're not careful, I mean, this is a gradual process, as you point out. So, you know, sometimes people don't realize how much they're giving away, how much of their own personal agency they're giving away. What's your end fear if we don't take stock of the way we're heading?
Well, I think we're on a path is one way to, we talk about this as a slippery sloped path that we are kind of, we're heading down a path. The destination, I hope we don't get there. I don't think we'll ever get there, but the end destination is basically a world in which we're all sort of plugged into an experience machine. Our entire experience of life from the time we're born to the time we die is subject to ubiquitous techno-social engineering, right? So everything we experience is highly determined, but not determined by like nature or fate or something like that, which the philosophers like to sort of talk about. No, it's engineered determinism, that we've engineered a world, a techno-social world, in which our lives are determined by the ubiquitous techno-social tools and environment. And within that, the real risk is that we lose, you know, what it means to be human, our ability to exercise free will, to have common sense, to relate to each other, to make choices about who we want to be and the lives we want to live, and to actually participate in the building of the world for ourselves and our children and our grandchildren and for future generations is a thing that we have less agency and autonomy about. That's the long run. I hope we don't get there. What we're trying to do, as you suggested, is sort of illustrate and draw people's attention to all of the little puzzle pieces that you start to put together, and you can kind of see that, you know, the path that we're on, you get a sort of better sense of what's happening and how we're going and what you can do about it. And I think right now, I mean, the big constitutional question we should, and I mean small c constitutional question we need to struggle with, is our freedom to be off, our freedom to have meaningful times in our lives that we're free from techno-social engineering by others.
Now, the way you describe it there sounds worrying, doesn't it? But in our daily lives, our interactions, say, with social media don't seem at all that concerning. In fact, they, as you point out, I mean, they're frictionless, they're seamless, you know, they add to the sort of ease, the sense of ease and simplicity in our lives. So that it's very hard to fight against something that's so seductive, isn't it?
It's hard to fight against it when it's subject to something called network effects. It's sort of the more the merrier. The more people that have it and you're a part of it, it's very hard to switch networks, to try something different. It's hard to find the space and freedom to be off. But also, and this is the thing that's very difficult to sort of get across, is the idea that our very beliefs and preferences are shaped over time by the environments within which we find ourselves. An entire generation of people's preferences regarding privacy have been shaped dramatically by social media. Social networking technologies have had a dramatic impact on our preferences for privacy. Now, you know, it's not that they're immutable and they're stuck, but they've certainly been shaped, and it's very hard to reassess, exercise your free will, and basically think about your preferences and say, well, you know what? I kind of prefer using social media because of the convenience and the ease, but I want to step back and rethink and reconsider, determine for myself a different preference. I want to sort of have a preference about my preferences that leads me to change. But change means that you have to actually challenge your own beliefs and preferences, which is hard.
But with these systems, with many of the systems that we operate today, with many of the systems which we use to engage with others, you have no choice in one sense, do you? You either accept all of the terms and conditions offered to you, or you don't use the platform, you don't use the system, you can't be employed by that workforce.
Well, and that's one of the all or nothing, take it or leave it nature of many of the techno-social systems is one of the big problems. So, you know, yeah, you can think about government regulation that seeks to break up monopolies to sort of induce competition in certain areas, and maybe that leads to more variety in terms of options. The response, it's complicated, right? So there's micro, meso, macro level responses depending on the context that we're talking about, like the kinds of issues. If we're talking about social media, it may be that, you know, there's inadequate competition, there's inadequate regulation, and there aren't sort of alternative options that are able to get any kind of scale, so people are more or less stuck. So although I think sometimes the choice is to say nothing. You can still relate to people and be successful in some cases by at least choosing to be off, or at least choosing to be off some of the time.
Well, Brett Fleischman from Villanova University and author of Reengineering Humanity, thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks.
Back in early April, as many nations were just beginning to understand the enormity of the task in combating COVID-19, a global coalition of 100 human rights and civil liberties organisations issued an urgent call to the world's leaders. COVID-19, they said, shouldn't be used as a cover for the further intrusion of digital surveillance into people's lives. So, in the 4 and a bit months since then, has their warning been heeded? Among the coalition was Australia's Digital Rights Watch. Its chair is lawyer Lizzie O'Shea.
I think a lot of civil society organisations that work in the field of digital rights are concerned in the time of a crisis like this, like a pandemic, that this will be an opportunistic chance for government to use surveillance technology for reasons other than health reasons. So I think when this crisis unfolded, a lot of civil society organisations were concerned that governments would exploit the opportunity to implement surveillance technology to inculcate a culture of surveillance and use the health concerns as a justification for that. So many civil society organisations work with government and advocate for policy reform on lots of different topics, but particularly in the digital rights space, they're accustomed to that kind of behaviour occurring. The obvious other example is in relation to terrorism, where the justification of terrorism has been used to implement all sorts of draconian legislative regimes around the world that are very invasive of people's rights and privacy.
And several months into this pandemic, are many countries exploiting this emergency to increase invasive or pervasive digital surveillance?
It's a real spectrum. Obviously, in somewhere like China, they use all sorts of technology to do all sorts of things, including contact tracing, but also policing and enforcing social distancing measures or stay-at-home orders. And then we have other countries like the United States, where police forces are now using facial recognition technology quite openly to police protests and the like that come out of things like the Black Lives Matter movement, which is occurring in the context of this pandemic. And then we have in between contact tracing apps. Around 50 countries have developed contact tracing apps. There's 80 in total, and these are being implemented in different parts of the world to different degrees and to different levels of success. So, you know, a lot of the surveillance technology that exists is being repurposed for health purposes, and this is both a problem and an opportunity. I think we can use technology in these ways to help stop the spread of the virus, but it is a problem when people can't trust it and they don't trust their government to do it well, because it comes off the back of this enormous state surveillance regimes that have been built.
And specifically in democratic countries, what can make the design and use of this type of technology inappropriate?
Well, there's been over 80 apps deployed to do contact tracing work. A fifth of those apps have no privacy policy in place. Nearly half of them don't have any clear guidance on how long this data will be held or disposed of. Even here in Australia, there isn't a clear endpoint to when the data that's collected through this app might be deleted. It's at the behest of the relevant minister when he declares that this pandemic is over. So these kinds of mechanisms are obviously introduced in a rush. but you can see how when the dust starts to settle, they may in fact have long-lasting consequences. There's a cultural aspect to this as well. There's a sense that in these times of crises, it's perfectly appropriate for governments to use technology in invasive ways that I think can take a long time to shift. And there's very moralistic overtones in some of these technology projects that suggest that if you're not on board with them, then somehow you're not on board with trying to stop the spread of the virus. And that kind of cultural response and the implementation of technology using that kind of cultural posture, I think, is a big problem. And we can then start to see how, you know, if we compare it with something like terrorism, it's been 2 decades since the 9/11 attacks, and we're still feeling the consequences legally, socially and culturally that come from that moment of crisis, and how those after effects are then implemented in various technological projects by government.
And just so there's no misunderstanding, your organisation, Digital Rights Watch, and this global coalition of human rights groups, you're not anti the use of technology for dealing with the pandemic, are you?
No, absolutely not. I think technology has a really important role to play, and I think anyone who's interested in digital rights would agree with that. Part of the disappointment of this current moment is that governments often rush to introduce technological initiatives, and you can see sometimes that they're motivated by their own interests as much as health protection interests, and that's a problem. I think rushing these projects and then deploying technology that has inbuilt biases or is problematic for other reasons means that the potential to tackle this pandemic using technology is undermined. I think technology definitely has a role to play in stopping the spread of this virus and making sure that we can limit its worst effects. But I'm not confident governments are necessarily doing the work to make sure that becomes a reality. And I think a lot of human rights organisations would argue quite rightly that implementing these projects with human rights at front of mind will give these projects the best chance of succeeding, because it will help build public trust in them. It will make sure that people feel they can use them without concerns for their privacy, and they'll opt in and have confidence that their government has their best interests at heart.
And who's most vulnerable or at risk of being marginalised because of the inappropriate use of this kind of technology?
Well, it's the same people in the real world as in cyberspace that are at risk, I think. It's the people who are over-policed, who are subject to biases already in the existing world. So, you know, minority populations, people of different races who often aren't given rights in the real world are often then subjected to the same kinds of bias and discrimination in online life. And so I think these things are related. The other point, of course, is that there is an accessibility issue that I don't think is often raised by government around things like contact tracing app technology. Some of the people who are most vulnerable to this particular virus are elderly people who may not be connected to the internet to the same degree as other sections of the population, that may not have access to the right kind of information to be able to protect themselves. And I think that is an issue we have to deal with. The digital divide exists across rich and poor, but also across particular populations who might not be able to access the internet. And facilitating better accessibility, I think, will give these projects a better chance of success. And some of the most vulnerable people are exactly the people who need that assistance.
Have we, though, seen any countries pedal back and start to reassess some of the terms and conditions, if you like, around the use of this technology?
Well, I think we've certainly seen different approaches, which then do have an impact on how successful this technology might be. A country like Iceland, for example, did have app technology that was probably towards the better end of the spectrum in terms of protecting rights, and they had a very high take-up rate for their contact tracing app at 38% of the population, which is still probably not high enough to make it effective, but that's much better than, say, in Australia or Singapore, where it was still below a quarter of the population. Similarly, in places like Germany, they opted for a decentralized model, which gave the population confidence that they could trust that technology, and that gets a better take-up rate and people are more likely to use it. So those kinds of technical design choices, I think, have social implications in how this technology might be taken up. And you can see how trust in government is probably the most critical factor to success, because it not only builds buy-in by the population, but it will also mean the government is more open, I think, to collaborating with expertise expertise that is available to them in their home country. I think one of the most disappointing things for lots of civil society organisations is that a lot of the problems that we've spoken about publicly have come to pass, and it becomes very frustrating when governments would prefer not to listen to their critics but instead proceed and then feel surprised when these problems end up eventuating. It would be much better if we had governments who were open, prepared to collaborate with experts outside of their ranks, and therefore in doing so, I think, build public trust in what they're doing.
And looking to the future, what's the chance that many of these governments will actually at some stage reassess the way in which they use this technology? Or is your fear that now that they've been introduced, that they'll simply be modified and used in other ways?
The obvious parallel that comes to mind is 9/11, where various measures were introduced in response to that terrorist attack that were considered unprecedented, and it's taken many years to roll back some of those practices and procedures. So I think we can assume that something similar may transpire here. I think we have got lots of civil society organisations who are advocating that that not transpire, to say that this is a temporary measure and we shouldn't continue to use technology that we've called for on an unprecedented level to deal with this crisis, that this shouldn't then continue after the pandemic has subsided. But I think this requires that organisations get active in advocating for this rather than just expect it to occur.
Liz O'Shea from Digital Rights Watch. And you're listening to Future Tense, exploring the world around us, looking for the pathways ahead, and signposting the future. I'm Anthony Fennell. Let's head to the top of the world now, and a preservation program with a difference.
Deep in the Arctic Circle, an archipelago covered in ice, Svalbard. And it is here you can find the Global Seed Vault. Millions of seeds have been sent here from across the globe for secure long-term storage in cold and dry rock vaults.
You may recall we covered the Arctic Seed Vault on the program just a few years back. Well, there are now efforts to build another Arctic Time Vault. This one's to be used by the software development platform GitHub, a subsidiary of Microsoft.
We will store the world's open source software on silver halide film. The data is encoded on frames with 8.8 million pixels each and designed to last over 1,000 years.
They're calling it the GitHub Archive Program, and Thomas Dumke is GitHub's Vice President of Strategic Programs.
The world today depends on software. If you think about our daily life, we are highly dependent on software, whether it's running on our computers or on our cell phones, whether it's about ordering a pizza, sending an email, or booking the next flight. And so a lot of this software is dependent on open source code. And what that means is that developers that are developing that software can read the source code. So I can go into a platform like GitHub and view the source code, copy it, modify it, and then send a change to that software back to original author, or can actually keep a copy of that source code for myself and develop my own products on it. And the GitHub Archive program has the idea of taking that software and putting it into an archive to preserve it for up to the next 1,000 years. Because we know from the past and from our own history that we have lost a lot of things. You know, losing a backup from a hard disk that you can no longer read because it was for 20 years in your basement. So we believe in 1,000 years, the world will be different. And similar how we had forgotten how the Romans created concrete, we will have forgotten how software development worked in the early 2000s, how developers around the world collaborated on software.
So you're going to preserve this software code by transferring it, as I understand it, to a special type of film, and then you're going to store it in the very north of Norway in an old abandoned mine shaft. Tell us about that.
That's right. So we at GitHub, we are a bunch of software developers, and our experience is in software development and not in archiving stuff. So we were looking for partners, and we actually partnered with a number of foundations, including the Internet Archive, which you might know from the Babic machine that shows you all web pages, the Software Heritage Foundation in Paris, and a company in Norway called the Arctic World Archive that runs an archive in the very north on an archipelago called Svalbard that also is the home of the Global Seed Vault. So similar to the Seed Vault that has all the seeds from all the countries around the world in it, they have an archive that stores film reels in a coal mine that has been disabled for a number of years. And so we picked that partner, and they have tested that those film reels will last for 1,000 years. In addition to this effort in the Cold War in Norway, we are also working with these other partners in other layers, and we call this a haze layer approach. So the cold layer is the one that goes into Norway, and then there's a warm layer where the source code is updated every couple of months or so into things like the Wabik machine. And then there's also a hot layer where the data is actually backupped in real time into systems like GHTorrent and GHArchive, which are two online projects that have been working on those kind of like archiving things.
And how have you made decisions about what code should be archived, and who makes those decisions?
So we are working not only with those partners, but also we have an advisory panel of archaeologists, humanists, different librarians, including somebody from the Library of Alexandria in Egypt. And so they have advised us of how we should run this program and what open source software is worthwhile to be archived.
So if we're talking about up to 1,000 years, I presume that there are instructions for future generations about how to unpack or to read the code.
That's a great question. If you would go into the mine in within the next 10, 20 years, you would actually find not only our film reels, but also a machine that will help you to read those film reels. Because while most of the instructions on those film reels are in human language, as in English or Spanish, a lot of the source code is printed in QR code or barcode, simply because we want to be able to compress most of the information into a higher density so we can store more on the same film reel. And so what you will find there is an introduction into what we call the tech tree. So we'll explain to you what software development is, what bits and bytes are, and then all the way to, you know, helping you to understand the structure of the archive and helping you to rebuild all those projects. You know, for example, Linux or the Android source code is part of the archive, so we'll be able to rebuild Android. It will, of course, take a lot of time unless you have some, you know, futuristic computer available to you that helps you with that. Otherwise, you basically have to rebuild hardware and software from scratch, but you're able to do so from all the information, do-it-yourself information that you can find on those film reels.
And is this project, is it basically historically focused? Are you preserving this code for the sake of historians, or do you see that there might be a possible practical reason why somebody would want to access this code in the future?
So I think it depends a little bit on whether you're speaking about what we put in the coal mine into the cold layer or into the hot layer or the warm layer in the middle. You might want to be able to go to the Wabik machine or the Internet Archive and just explore what a certain software repository looked like 10 years ago or 5 years ago. It's just interesting, you know, for us, in the same way that you might go to Wikipedia to read up on a certain topic. So I think there's like normal use cases that exist today. But then there's also the historical importance of all this open source code that we think will be interesting in 1,000 years. And then the historical aspects are coming in.
Just finally, do you see this as an ongoing project? I mean, will you be going back and in a couple of years' time again looking at new code that you would want to store and trying to archive it?
Definitely. So we have it as an ongoing project. If you think about the hot and the warm layer, the collaboration with the Internet Archive or the Software Heritage Foundation, we will ongoing backup to those servers. And then we also have plans to go back to Svalbard in a 2 years or 3 year time frame to do a refresh of the repositories there. We haven't decided yet of which repositories we might update, and that is a process that we're working on with our advisors and partners.
Thomas Dumke, thank you very much for joining us on Future Tense.
Thank you, bye.
And it's bye also from us, because that's the end of Future Tense for another week. Details about our guests today and their work can be found on our website. My colleague and co-producer is Karin Savanovitz. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.